The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Over to New York, where Danny Schechter joins us. He's with he's the editor of MediaChannel.org. Many thanks for joining us here on Press TV, sir. Now, I would like to get your reaction on this analysis that has just come out, that even if these revolutions and uprisings in the Middle East and North Africa manage to topple their dictators, there can be no real democracy without economic prosperity. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, to have democracy, to have a real democracy, you need a culture of democracy. You need institutions. You need free elections. You need a free press. You need television that's open to different points of view. And that's certainly not the case in Libya. It certainly wasn't the case in Egypt. So it's not surprising that, you know, you can't have democracy in a second. You really need some time to create the environment for it, and that hasn't happened yet.
Well, I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector here. We are on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. This is News Dissector Radio. We're improvising as we go along because we're talking about, in our first half hour, Libya and what's happening in Libya. The latest news, defiant Libyans flood the streets of Tripoli to protest against Muammar Gaddafi. Thousands of demonstrators take to the streets of Libya's capital today. After Friday prayers, at least some members of the security forces support them. But one man reports that people have been killed. Gaddafi himself has gone back on TV and says, "I will fight and we will prevail," adding, "Dance, sing, and celebrate. The man is mad." We'll be more on Libya coming up, and you can join us at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. In the second half of the program, we'll be joined by Ed Rampell in Hollywood to talk about the Oscars coming up this weekend, and also to add some of his perspectives about progressives in Hollywood. So that's all coming today on News Dissector Radio. Stay with us. Well, it's power to the people in Libya and throughout the Arab world, where people have taken to the streets, are basically toppling governments, toppling and challenging monarchs, putting the United States in a very tenuous position, because the United States supported a lot of the people who the people in the countries are actually opposing, in Yemen, in Bahrain, in Egypt, in Tunisia. All of those governments supported by the U.S. government, and the same was true in Libya, actually, where there were deals going on between American oil companies and the Libyans. So this is an issue that's extremely important. The question is, what will happen now? Will the United States sit by, or will it get more engaged? President Obama, just 2 days ago, said he's putting all options on the table. Now, when you say that, all options, that includes military options. And there's a big meeting going on in Europe with David Cameron of the UK, Sarkozy of France, and others, probably NATO generals, to talk about some sort of intervention potentially in Libya. This is a very serious thing. Why would they want to intervene in Libya? To defend democracy for the people? I don't think so. I think that there's a shorter word that might explain it all, O-I-L, oil. And, you know, Libyan oil is now maybe up for grabs in their view. So you have the potential here of a U.S. intervention. Fidel Castro, 2 days ago, in one of his commentaries, predicted a Western invasion or intervention. Now, the way these things work, it's generally speaking not necessarily with American troops. They create a pan-Arab military force, or using their allies from various countries who can deploy rapidly into Libya, from Italy, from France, from England, and other countries. So we have to be mindful of what's at stake here. This is not just all about freedom. It's not just all about getting rid of a bad and seemingly mad leader. It's also about economic interests and strategic interests. With the setback in Egypt, with Mubarak being toppled, a U.S.-supported, you know, dictator supported by the U.S. for 30 years. 30 years. You rarely heard any mention of that, you know, on all the television programs about the Egyptian revolution. The American role in Egypt was rarely mentioned. Well, guess what? Now we have a situation where Libya is on fire, basically, and it appears as if seven colonels in the Libyan army have sort of defected and have created a military force within the military. Now, was it a domestic, totally domestic inspired, or was it internationally inspired? We don't know those details. Gaddafi, for his part, is blaming all of this, get this, on people taking drugs, drugs given to them by Osama bin Laden. So this thing is bizarre. You know, whenever Muammar Gaddafi opens his mouth, often an unpredictable litany or rant comes out of it. And that's what we're hearing now in Libya from him. I have to tell you that I met Gaddafi in South Africa at the inauguration of President Mbeki some years ago. He was standing right in front of me with this big entourage, walking, swaggering around like some sort of a king. He calls himself a revolutionary. That's really in question right now, who the revolutionary and who the counter-revolutionary is. Just last night, I was called from Iran, of all places, to comment on what's happening in Libya. I mean, I live in New York. How do I know? I don't have the details of Libya, but they were interested in my perspective on American foreign policy. And so we did this interview on Press TV that went actually live worldwide on Press TV. Press TV is like the CNN of Iran, and I'll tell you, it's more open to different points of view than our CNN. So yes, it's Iranian-backed. On the other hand, it's not dominated totally by Iranian government, you know, propaganda. A lot of other voices are on there, and I'm one of them from time to time. So here's that interview. I'm going to pick up on it now. Your news dissector, Danny Schechter, live in Tehran. Check it out.
Another analysis that came out was that this rising tide of people power is so intense that the Middle East will either become democratic or it will come under more stern control. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, there are options in between, you know, all or nothing. But, you know, I think the situation in Libya is dangerous for another reason that you haven't mentioned, or maybe your earlier guests mentioned. The Western countries are meeting to try to discuss various approaches and options, including military options. Fidel Castro has warned of a possible military intervention. You know, the president's former chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, who's just elected mayor of Chicago, is famous for having said that, you know, a good crisis is a terrible thing to waste. And there's an opportunity here, perhaps, for Western powers, NATO, the United States, to intervene, allegedly on a humanitarian basis, but actually to try to seize the oil or get control of the oil in Libya. So there is a danger here of external intervention, and I think that's part of, you know, Gaddafi's fear, maybe his paranoia, and what he's doing might be bringing it about, actually, by his actions, which, you know, there was some correspondence on another network were basically saying, can he be excused for what he's doing because he's so mentally imbalanced? We just don't know.
Right, but then these people are rising against Gaddafi's tyrannical rule. Will they tolerate such blatant intervention by foreign forces in their country's affairs?
Well, you know, to stop an intervention by foreign forces, you have to be armed in some way. In Iraq, there was an army. The army kind of disappeared into the city, but it still had arms. It became a resistance. In Libya, the military has control, and there seems to be a lot of conflict within the military. You need people who can fight against the foreign intervention. Some people there, considering all the people who have died, are likely to welcome it as a way to solve this problem, or at least to end the killing. So it's unclear what is going to happen right now, and that's all this uncertainty has driven up the price of oil and has created tremendous instability and uncertainty in many governments. China, for example, is very upset because Chinese construction projects and aid projects have been looted by the people and destroyed, and China's lost a lot of money there.
Right now, also an interesting aspect is that there is talk of the Egyptian army intervening in Libya. How likely is that to happen, and how likely is it for world bodies such as the UN and EU to support such an intervention?
Well, don't forget, the Egyptian army was funded by the United States and trained and influenced by the United States. What they're talking about is trying to, Cameron, Sarkozy, and Obama's people are talking about maybe a pan-Arab force of some kind, which could include Egyptian military to intervene. I don't think they want to have a foreign intervention totally, but to go through surrogates, people they already know and they've already funded. So this is all speculation. Of course, we have no evidence that that's going to happen, but there is that concern. And already some Libyan officials are warning against a foreign intervention because it looks like that could be in the cards here. So we really don't know yet. That's why it's a very dynamic and volatile situation.
Well, that was me on Press TV, the sounds coming from Libya, very eerie in the background, the sounds of conflict, the sounds of protest, and the sounds of repression as the Libyan government and Gaddafi and his people try to put the cork back into the bottle, but it's unlikely that that's going to happen. They see the opposition there, who are now being called rebels before they were called people, are now said to be in striking distance of Tripoli. And they seem to be confident of toppling Gaddafi. Gaddafi has been using mercenaries, has been using, what's left, remnants of the army, some of those people defecting. So this is all something that I believe we have to watch closely, and we have to be concerned about the human rights abuses there, as many as 6,000 dead, according to one estimate and report. Foreign media have been all but banned from traveling to Libya, although many journalists have entered through Eastern Libya, which is now under the control of the opposition. And so the Libyan people, inspired perhaps by what happened in Tunisia and Egypt, have taken things into their own hand now. And, the question of what happens, there's refugees fleeing the country, there's a government and other governments like ours trying to evacuate our citizens from Libya. It's chaos in many respects. Now, joining me now, and I'm really happy that she could, is a Libyan goes to, I believe, Columbia University, but is an activist for democracy in Libya. And we didn't reach her, so I haven't had a chance to talk to her before, but we'll talk to her right now. Hi, Najla, could you introduce yourself to our audience so that they know who you are?
Hi, my name is Najla Abdirahman. I'm a student at Columbia, a Libyan-American.
And you've been following these developments. How do you feel about what's happening as a Libyan?
Really very concerned, very concerned. Obviously, it's been a very tumultuous week and a half now. A lot of violence, a lot of bloodshed. We're excited that the people have decided to rise up against the regime, this horrible regime for the last 40 years, which has choked the country. But at the same time, we're hearing word of massive casualties, friends and family being shot, and everyone's just really, really concerned right now, but hopeful at the same time.
Well, there's been reports of marches from mosques to Green Square in the heart of the capital. And at least some of the security people seem to be supporting the protesters.
Well, actually, today, I'm not sure if you have seen in the news, but Gaddafi made a surprise appearance from Green Square, or supposedly it aired on state TV just a little while ago. They even panned onto the clock to sort of prove what the date was. We got word from people in Tripoli, protesters who tried to make it to Green Square earlier, but it was tightly guarded, and now we know why. But they were being shot at. A friend of ours actually was shot earlier today. He's fine. They were trying to get into Green Square, but they couldn't, and they turned them around. Other protests in different areas in Tripoli as well today. But I mean, Tripoli is just under siege. It's borne the brunt of the violence over this whole thing because it's the capital. It's the most important city in Libya. It's the seat of power, and where most of the security forces are concentrated. And if Gaddafi loses this, then he knows that he loses Libya.
Well, you know, last night, I don't know if you saw Jon Stewart, the Daily Show, you know, sort of making fun of Gaddafi, you know, saying that, you know, he was going to go to Green Square before to be with the people, but it was raining. It was raining, so he couldn't possibly go in the rain. You can understand that. But, you know...
Right, and, yeah, he was alluding to that sort of, that quote-unquote statement that he made the other day, where he was holding up an umbrella and sort of sitting out of the door of a van, and saying that he was going to address the youth in Green Square, but it was raining and he couldn't make it.
Yeah, right. but then he said he blamed the protesters. He said they're being drugged by Al Qaeda with
right.
You know, hallucinogenic drugs. It sounded like something out of the 60s. You know, on two sides. One, you know, in the civil rights movement here, people in the Deep South would always denounce outside agitators. They were responsible for everything. And in this case, of course, the outside agitators are Al Qaeda or Al Jazeera, who sort of blend together in his mind, and he denounced.
But not just Al Qaeda, not just Al Jazeera. Everybody, the West, foreign elements, the rest of the Arab world. I mean, he's blamed Libyans themselves. I mean, this is the rhetoric of a desperate and, let's face it, delusional individual. Nobody is really listening very much to what he is saying since. That message from the van under the umbrella. He gave a long and rambling speech a couple of days ago. I'm sure you saw it.
I did. Yeah.
And then today's statement. I mean, even the news stations like Al Jazeera just cut him off after a while in his last speech, and I just had to turn it off because it was just, you know, no one's really listening to him anymore. Just sort of waiting for it to all go away.
I mean, it's almost like a caricature, I mean, it seems to me, of a despot in terrible despot who's in the pot,
right.
You know, and the
right.
pot is being, he's being cooked in it, you know.
Exactly, but and it would be funny if he didn't, you know, have so much firepower and so many mercenaries and things at his disposal. When you have that combination of, you know, just pure delusion and insanity and megalomania and desperation, you know, and you add to that the firepower that he has and the ability he has to take, you know, retribution on the people. It, you know, his personality is laughable, but the situation is far from funny.
Well, it's not funny at all. In fact, you know, I just had a few questions as somebody who's followed this situation closely and who knows it so much better, of course, than most of us. Was this a big surprise to you, a big shock that suddenly, you know, a regime that seemed impregnable, you know, unable to be challenged, responsible for so many human rights abuses over the years, that this kind of a regime could be challenged and could be crumbling after just a few weeks?
Yes, you know, yes and no. I mean, here's the thing. Nobody thought it would happen, you know, a few months ago and for the past many years. And, you know, we thought that he might be there until, you know, he died and then when it took over. And there have been opposition groups from outside of the country that have worked in the past and they've all failed. And so it was sort of looking like a hopeless situation, you know. But then, you know, as everybody knows, then Tunisia happened and Egypt happened and everything changed. And there was just a shift in everybody's psychology. And when they saw that it could happen, you know, in neighboring states, they realized that, you know, they could do it too. Despite what happened in Tunisia and Egypt, people still had doubts about whether it could happen in Libya because they knew the psychology of Gaddafi and how brutal he would be and that he wouldn't let go as easily as Mubarak and as easily as Ben Ali and that he wouldn't care. They knew they had the eyes of the world on them and they were cognizant of that and so they were careful in a sense that Gaddafi is somebody who doesn't care what anybody thinks about him.
Well, you know, it's, and his sons, they are also quite a group, aren't they? You know,
yeah.
I mean, you can't make this up. I mean, I think if you went to Hollywood with a script, they would reject it as being, you know, as implausible. You know,
right.
It seems like, you know, sometimes real life is much more complicated than fiction, even in terms of, you know, just not being even predictable. But here we have a situation where, you know, Gaddafi is now Mr. Bad Guy. But wasn't there a rapprochement between Gaddafi and Washington under the Bush administration? Wasn't there, you know, Gaddafi kind of joined the war on terror and did various favors for the United States, and the oil companies in the United States were making deals with Gaddafi?
Yes, from what I've heard, it actually started under the Clinton administration, late in the Clinton years. Gaddafi had information, or supposedly had information, on so-called Islamic militants. And so he was willing to cooperate with Washington in getting names and turning people over and things like that. So basically they made a deal with the devil in that sense. Was it worth it? I don't know. But that's what happened, and that's what it was about.
You know, this is why it's so really too easy to stereotype things as in one-dimensional terms, because this is far more complex and complicated. The other day, I was reading Juan Cole, who's a historian out of the University of Michigan, who follows the Middle East, brilliant guy. And, you know, he was making a reference. He says, you know, the right wing in America keeps talking about Islamo-fascists. He says, but Libya had a real experience with fascists. Libya was bombed from the air, you know, a million people, I don't know how many, but tons of people were killed by you know, bombing by Italy, who a fascist state at the time. So, you know, this is not a joke, you know, and to talk about this so, you know, kind of off the top of your head as if it's meaningful, it's completely ridiculous.
Right. I mean, I think that term is just an absurd term coined by people who are trying to fearmonger, and we reject it completely. And are not extremist by in any sense of the word. I've been to Libya a few times. They're very moderate, very reasonable people, and they just are, when they hear that, they're just very surprised. And I mean, I can't speak for everybody, but I could definitely say that those concerns are probably unfounded.
But I also think that, you know, they may be very reasonable, but they're also very brave. I mean, to stand up as the people there have against guns, against, you know, being strafed from the air, being attacked by foreign mercenaries, and yet not giving in. I mean, that's pretty amazing. I think, you know, you get up to a point where you're ready to die, in a sense. You're ready to fight. You know, you're not going to give up.
And those are the stories that we're hearing from people willing to risk their lives, people, you know, creating human shields. So amazing stories that are going to come out once this is all over, of people just, you know, willing to die for their countrymen and for their country. And, you know, they just have such a determination in their fear. I mean, obviously there's fear when you're confronted with guns and with bullets and with mercenaries, but the fear that existed for the last 40 years, they say that's gone and there's no turning back. And I, for one, and all Libyans watching in the exile community are so proud, so unbelievably proud of these people, and just, you know, standing in awe of them.
Well, you know, I think Americans have to also express solidarity. We have tended in recent years to be very inward looking and not really pay attention to what's happening, you know, in Afghanistan, where, you know, today it was announced that the U.S. is withdrawing from a valley that was created, you know, crucial. Over 100 American soldiers died for this, you know, to save this place, and now that we're just abandoning it. I mean, it looks like defeat is in the air in Afghanistan, but there's been very little protest about it. And this whole situation, I was really pleased to see a sign in Egypt, somebody holding up a sign in Tahrir Square saying, "We are with the people of Wisconsin."
Yeah, and the people of Wisconsin are with the people of Egypt. It's stunning. It's incredible, you know.
But just tell us, if you would, you know, because you're on top of this. I mean, I have a lot of Twitter tweets here going on about, you know, Al Jazeera anchors now debating with a psychologist if Gaddafi can be excused for his behavior because he's mentally insane, okay? Another saying, you know, the government is promising to pay people to send pro-Gaddafi text images to their messages to their friends. But another one that's very important says, Libya Libya is not in civil war. This is a state and regime attacking a whole population. And you know, it's too easy to, you know, look at this, you know, in a simplistic way. And I think you and your colleagues who are Libyans living in America or who are here for various reasons, who've been protesting at the UN, who've been standing up, really should know that many Americans really support you in this effort. We want to see a Libya ruled by Libyans, not by Americans, oil companies, Chinese, or Saudi or Saudis, you know, or Iranians. We want to see, you know,
that makes me very happy. And for the Libyan people, it's very important as well that they have the support of the American public. That means, I mean, that's something that's very important to
the
American government and the American public.
That's why I wanted you on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. And if you, afterwards, I'll call you, and then there'll be a podcast of this show that I can send you. And we'd also like to know, are there any websites that you're checking out for information that people here should know about?
Yes, our organization, which is called Enough Gaddafi, had a website. It was hacked last week by God knows who. But they, the amazing people working on it 24/7 have since put up two new sites. One is feb17.info, feb17.info, where they can get the latest videos, pictures, stories. I mean, it's being updated every single hour. They're getting all new information from their contacts there. The other really great resource is one called February 17 Voices, which they can Google February 17 Voices and it'll come up. I believe the website's address is libyafeb17.com.
Libyafeb17.com. Check that out.
Right.
This is important because, you know, because American TV anchors are not on the scene. You know, Katie Couric hasn't made it yet, and Brian Williams and everything.
Right.
You know, so it doesn't get.
I mean, there are people in Benghazi. The CNN has put people on the ground in Benghazi, and I have been in contact with journalists who are headed towards Tripoli. For Tripoli. Some have already left. Let me just mention something about this. The second site, LibyaSub17.com, there is a link at the top of it to AudioBoo, which is hosting. What we've done is we've called people in Libya every day to get sort of eyewitness reports, recorded them, and uploaded them to that site. So on there they can find a link to Libya, to February 17 Voices, and hear updates from people all over Libya every day.
Well, that is so fabulous. Thank you so much for joining me here today on the News Dissector radio show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. This is the kind of reporting, the kind of information that you don't get in many other places. And this is a new media world now where you can go online and you can see images and get information without going through traditional news organizations that tend to skew it. You know, I was at ABC News for 8 years, so I know something about of which I speak, if you will. And mediachannel.org are my website and my blog, newsdissector.com/blog. We'll carry more on this. We will have this podcast. And thank you again for joining us. Give our blessings and solidarity to your you know, colleagues and fellow citizens who are fighting for freedom in Libya. And we want to see an outcome that's not dominated by foreign powers, but something that the Libyan people decide for themselves. So, again, thanks so much.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Sally May, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hey, Lee.
Yeah, Jeff.
Your girlfriend gave another interview.
No, don't play it.
Listen to this.
I have a
journalism degree. That is what I studied. I understand that this cornerstone of our democracy is a free press.
Shut it off. I said not to play it.
We are in the worst reality show in history.
Why won't she shut up?
You know she's going to be president, right?
Okay, stop it. That's not funny. That's not funny.
I think we should just go limp. Lay back. Maybe then the mama grizzly won't tear off your limbs. Cheater in the Rood. Thursdays, 8 p.m. Progressive Radio Network.
South of the border.
Hello, I'm Johnny Mueller, and I have a brand new show called The Expat Files, and it's all about living, working, playing, or retiring in Latin America. I know what it's like to buy land, build a house, start a business. I've been through it in a dozen Latin countries. So, if you're thinking about moving down, or you're just curious, be sure to listen in, Mondays and Wednesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Down Mexico way.
Hello, I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and you can hear my program, If You Love This Planet, right here on the Progressive Radio Network, every Sunday at 3 p.m. Please join me as I interview a huge variety of special guests from around the world about a range of topics, including the health of the planet and prescriptions for survival. So, if you do love this planet, tune in to the Progressive Radio Network every Sunday at 3 p.m.
Let your imagination fly. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Take a trip with me through the literary landscape of Writer's Voice. Join the tour and the conversation as we talk with writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Right here on the Progressive Radio Network, every Saturday at noon.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
This is Adam Colker with Brooklyn Jazz Underground Radio. We'll be here every Tuesday from 5 to 6 with great music, interviews, and live performances. Right here on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network. Again, that's Tuesdays from 5 to 6, or you can listen anytime at the archives at progressiveradionetwork.com.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong. Criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold.
When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid off workers, paid off.
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Credit swaps, credit stocks, empty wallets, and empty shops. Then bank walk in the AAA. Grandpa loses 401k.
Well, that's the theme song to the movie Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, that I directed, which is my film, which is not in the Oscars this year. And it will not be, you know, in the Oscars. There is another film about the financial crisis, and we'll chat a little bit about that. But I'm really pleased to be able to talk about this. The New York Times today is filled with Oscar predictions and pictures of all the stars and the directors. And, of course, you know, I believe that all this coverage that they get is a sort of payback for all of the advertising that the studios take out in the major newspapers and on television. Hence, this becomes such a big issue, the annual Oscar ritual. But joining me from Hollywood is a writer who writes about the politics of the motion picture industry. He's a film historian. He's a brilliant journalist. He's a friend of mine, Ed Rampell. Are you there, Ed?
Great to join you, Danny. How you doing?
Good. There we go. So Ed is with us. And you know, Ed, I was just saying, you know, we're in a situation where the Oscars constantly have to sort of reinvent themselves. There's a big thing in the New York Times today about how, you know, they're going younger all the time to try to, in a sense, bring in this young audience, because movie going is down. And part of it is that the Oscar doesn't have the elan that it once had, because there's so many other every other hour there seems to be another, you know, award show of some kind, you know, the country music rhythm and blues award show or whatever. And, you know, so the whole notion of these award programs sort of lost their luster a little bit. And the movies have become so expensive that fewer people are going. But what is the environment that we're in at 2011's Oscar on Oscar night? You know, we're coming up on Sunday. What is the environment here in the movie business and in your mind that, you know, our viewers, our readers, we are seeing on an internet feed here, webcast, you know, should look for on Oscar night?
Well, first of all, just from a film historian point of view, the Motion Picture Academy of Arts and Sciences established in the late 1920s and began the Oscars as a way to promote the films and the film industry. That was the purpose. And never underestimate the power of people sitting around and patting themselves on the back. And in terms of the youth demographic, let's just be thankful, Danny, that Justin Bieber isn't the MC this year.
Right.
Of course, Los Angeles is a company town, and the way that the Oscars actually affects LA is in a number of ways. There's obviously from the business point of view, which you were talking about, and this is kind of the ultimate award ceremony. It's sort of the Nobel Prizes for the entertainment industry, if you will. But it also affects people in terms of the road closures. Danny, you and I have hung out together in New York and also in L.A. And you know, as somebody who goes to L.A., and you're quite an accomplished filmmaker yourself, and I've been to a premiere of one of your films in Los Angeles, and you know how horrendous the traffic could be. So imagine how much worse it is with the road closures. This is something that is kind of overlooked in all the glitzy, glamorous, tabloidy type stories. But in terms of the nitty gritty, that's one way that it affects us.
I'm talking though really about, I wouldn't quite compare it to the Nobel Prize, although the Nobel Prizes have been debased somewhat in recent years, as we all know, from the days that Dr. King, you know, received the Nobel Prize. I mean, I don't think Barack Obama walks in his shoes exactly. But, you know, here we have an industry. Here we have a business, because this is show business, not show art. This is a business and industry, and yet this industry is basically dominating our culture in so many ways, by its power, by its advertising dollars, you know, by all the other media that revolves around, you know, the Oscars and the movie industry and movie biz and the stars and all the rest of it. It's sort of, in a way, become, you know, it was always called the illusion factory. And, you know, it looks like today it's just so institutionalized, if you will.
That's true, but we should not forget that in terms of the creative process, there is still a need for artists, not just sausage making. And artists are often, not always, but often have conscience and consciousness. And that's why a group of international left-leaning film critics, film historians, cinema scholars, etc., have banded together to annually award the Progies. for the best progressive films and filmmakers.
I love that, the Progies. Now, you've had your first ceremony or your first event or not yet?
Well, the Progies began 4 years ago when I noticed, I wrote a book that I believe you may have seen. You're in it. It's called Progressive Hollywood.
It's a great
People,
book, yeah.
Film History of the United States. And at that time, I noticed when I completed the book in very early 2005 that spearheaded by people like you with your Weapons of Mass Deception, excellent documentary, obviously spearheaded by Michael Moore also, there was a revival after 9/11 of progressive documentaries because the masses were not getting the information from mainstream media. And I document in my book 50 post-9/11 progressive documentaries. At that time, there were only about 5 progressive feature films out, such as Frida. But I predicted that there would be a trend of progressive feature films with scripts, actors, etc. And sure enough, that came to pass. And the movie Crash, which was a $4 or $6 million small kind of indie film about racism, went on to win the Best Picture Oscar. You had Good Night and Good Luck about my namesake, Edward R. Murrow, et cetera. And we had the rise of progressive feature films. But then by 2007, the Iraq War and Afghan War and War on Terror feature films such as Rendition with Reese Witherspoon and Meryl Streep, Redacted, directed by Brian De Palma, who did very commercial movies such as The Untouchables. These movies did not perform well at all at the box office. A Robert Redford Afghan War movie was another bomb. And the progressive audience began to wane. So I thought it was necessary to shine a light on progressive movies, because if there isn't a progressive audience to support films of conscience and consciousness, it'll be much harder not only to get them made, but to get them distributed.
Well, you can say that again, because it's, I've made what I think is my best film, Plunder, the Crime of Our Time, and, I have really no effective distribution. I don't have the resources that Michael has in terms of, being able to get his films out there, although you'll note that he is suing Harvey Weinstein, claiming that he was robbed in Fahrenheit 9/11 in terms of the money that was made on that. But, Inside Job is made by a guy who's, very wealthy. He took $100 million out of a company that he created and sold. So, but for somebody who it doesn't have that kind of support, it's hard to market a progressive film. I mean, my experience is that when people see it, they really appreciate it, they really like it. I get a tremendous amount of mail, and, we have the PlunderTheCrimeOfOurTime.com website. People come to it. But if you don't have a distribution, it's not a contender in any way.
That's right. It's sort of like that Zen koan. If a film is made but nobody sees or hears it, was it really made, so to speak? And that's the raison d'etre. That's the reason for the Progies. I hasten to add that that we're not getting advertising dollars or commercial support from independent or studios that make the progressive films. It's not commercial, but we do recognize the importance of audiences, and so do filmmakers. People like you make films because you want them to be seen and you want them to have an impact. And so what we're doing is highlighting those films that are often, not always, but often overlooked by the Academy Awards. We call it the People's Oscar or the Anti-Oscar. And this year's big winner for the Progies, winning in a third of all the categories, is called Even the Rain, which is a Spanish film that was shot on location in Bolivia. It's it stars Gael Garcia Bernal, who played Che Guevara not only in the Motorcycle Diaries, but in, I think it was a Showtime, a two-part made-for-TV movie called Fidel, where he played the older Che Guevara before he played the younger Che Guevara, by the way. And he stars as a movie director who goes to Bolivia to direct a feature film about Christopher Columbus and the conquistadors' subsequent conquest of what we now call parts of Latin America. And this is set against the water wars, the People's Power Uprising in Cochabamba.
Yeah, I know about all that. There's been some excellent documentaries and reporting on that.
It was quite an amazing uprising of the Bolivian people. One could kind of say it was Che Guevara's revenge. Of course, he was assassinated in Bolivia in 1967. And the title, Even the Rain, comes from the mouth of one of the Bolivian demonstrators who is complaining that a multinational corporation has taken over, completely privatized and taken over the water supply for Cochabamba. And they've made it illegal for people to catch rainwater in their catchments. They have to buy every drop of water. And so the protester says, even the rain, meaning that they can't even drink the rainwater for free anymore. And it's a really great film. It just opened, I think, Friday here in Los Angeles. And this is one of the great things about the James Agee Cinema Circle, which is this group, an international group of lefty film critics. They not only try and bring films to the attention of the general public that have merit because of progressive politics and so on, but they also bring films to the attention of other film critics. And to be candid, I hadn't heard of it until it was brought to my attention by my fellow critics. And last Monday, I went to a panel discussion that I participated in, led by the film critic Stephen Farber, after a screening of Even the Rain. And I have to tell you, we have a secret ballot in the James Agee Cinema Circle, but I will reveal that I did change my vote from the nominations for the actual winners. I did vote for Even the Rain in a number of categories.
So, I mean, but I think this testifies to how much great work there is out there in the world of incredible film, and how little of it seems to get seen in America. You know, when I was in college, something like 6 or 7% of all the films shown in America were foreign language films shown at so-called art houses. Today, it's, you know, 0.06%, if that, you know, in terms of getting out there. Now, there seems to be more coming in, and it's interesting that, you know, even this year with the Oscars, there are films that are showing in mainstream theaters, like Beautiful, which is a fabulous film that shows it's a Mexican film or Spanish film, but it's a powerful film about immigration, about exploitation, and many other issues that I was very impressed with. I mean, The King's Speech is certainly a film that raises an issue about fascism in England before World War II that many people may not be fully aware of. And, you know, that the King Edward, who basically abdicated the throne, was very, you know, kind of doing business with the Nazis, if you will. And so there's a lot, and of course, Social Network, you know, deals with a medium that has become a lot more political and a lot more impactful in the world than it certainly was in that film. But, you know, it seems as if there are more contemporary themes in films that are getting seen and getting on television. And I think that's important. And I think what you're doing is particularly important. I mean, would you be interested in maybe doing a regular radio show about this here on Progressive Radio Network?
Absolutely. Well, I think it's a great idea.
Okay, I would just like to nominate you now. if the people at Progressive Radio Network are listening, for the most promising radio program, a regular report from Hollywood, because Ed Rappel is following these issues in detail, understands them from a historical perspective and a political context point of view that, you know, is all too rare, if you will, in a lot of the critics who focus more on performance and, you know, and celebrity and all the rest of it.
Yeah, in my book, Progressive Hollywood, I never talk about what who are they wearing, what gown or what is tuxedo, is it Armani, Prada, mm-hmm. etc. I never talk about their private life scandals, etc. That's kind of the trivial stuff. Jay Leno had Helena Bonham Carter on his show recently, and she's actually quite a gifted actress. She, of course, is up for the Best Supporting Actress for The King's Speech, which, you're correct, is an anti-fascist movie. And his conversation with Helena Bonham Carter was more about her sleeping arrangements, literally. Her sleeping arrangements with Tim Burton, her husband or her partner. And this is the kind of trivia that they focus on.
You know, Tom Hooper, the director of that film, somebody I met in South Africa, where he made a struggle film. And he will be directing Nelson Mandela's Long Walk to Freedom after this project is over. And so, you know, these are people, a lot of these people are people with a tremendous amount of social consciousness and a lot of caring, and they're not to be, you know, treated, you know, dismissively. I mean, they really have not only a lot to say, but they use film to say it. And Mike Lee from England, how do you pronounce it?
I say Lay.
Okay. This film, Another Year, really talks about some of the loneliness and, you know, problems affecting working class people in England and the like. I mean, there is a lot to find in the cinema if you, you know, are conscious enough to know where to go and what to look for. I mean, I will tell you that we were giving out, they don't know it yet, but, you know, the Globie, you know, here at Global Vision, for the top interns of the month, and two of them are in the studio now. The Green Arrow, a rapper, Kat is here in a red gown, looking magnificent. She's just come off the basic, you know, come off. What is it? The walk. What is it? What they call
the red carpet.
The red carpet. There you go. I actually covered the red carpet when I worked for ABC News. I was actually out in L.A. Watching that whole ritual and going to one of the Oscar parties and vowed I would never do it again. And, you know, how do people reach you and find out more about the Progies and tell us about your book again? Because I think it's very important. And as there's all this buzz going on about the Oscars this weekend and it's going to be all over television, your voice really deserves to be heard.
Thank you. There are several websites where they could read my reviews, HollywoodProgressive.com. You could go to Jester Entertainment online. And the book is called Progressive Hollywood, A People's Film History of the United States. And there are progressive movies out there. People have got to go see them. The Best Progressive Documentary Progie Award winner this year is Inside Job, about the theft on Wall Street.
That's because you didn't consider Plunder. I think that's probably the reason. But leave that alone. Leave that aside for now. I am pleased to know that I am referenced in your book, Progressive Hollywood.
Absolutely. You're one of the most important filmmakers out there. You had one of the early documentaries questioning all the lies from the mainstream media and that notorious war criminal, Donald Rumsfeld, who's trying to peddle his wares now in Weapons of Mass Deception. Great documentary. And there's also good feature films even made by the studios. Fair Game, Naomi Watts won for the Best Progressive Actress. The winner of the Jean Renoir Progie Award for Best Anti-War Film, Matt Damon's The Green Zone, which exposes all the lies that Rumsfeld and Bush and those scum of the earth made about the weapons of mass destruction. So there are good films made by studios. My favorite of last year was Made in Dagenham, which precedes
a film about the women going out on strike in England, correct? Is that it?
Absolutely, starring the wonderful Sally Hawkins, who appeared in Mike Lee's Happy Go Lucky. She had the lead in that, and she was up for the Best Actress Pierogi, but lost out to Naomi Watts. Made in Dagenham, a very delightful, very entertaining, very uplifting pro-women's right, pro-workers' right strike film.
Which is something we really need more of, given what's happening in Wisconsin. By the way, tomorrow in state capitals across America, at high noon, there's going to be national demonstrations in solidarity with the people of Wisconsin. I wanted to get that in and announce that. So this is something that, you know, is something galvanizing people here. And I was on the air with a woman from Libya earlier who also gave praise to the people of Wisconsin. So, you know, this is something, this is a very dramatic time right now, both of bad and good. And I'm really happy that we could have this kind of political discussion here on News Dissector Radio on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. If you want to reach me, write to dissector@mediachannel.org. We'll have the podcast up on as soon as we get it on my blog at newsdissector.com/blog. Thank you to all at PRN for helping us bring this program to you, to Gary Knoll, to the whole team here who are doing a great job trying to build an audience for progressive ideas, and I'm happy to be part of it. So for this week, I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector, saying bye-bye.
Wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
40% of the station carried no news of the world.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is identification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murder gets Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, by a Coke, by a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
And experience your psychic connection.
We don't have shit to say. We don't have anything to do.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plans to